that, because what I'm going to say about certain logistical concerns I think affects her. And I don't have to say it over and over again. How many people have turned it in already? You have? Okay. Well, whatever, I'll just start talking about it again. If possible, try to upload smaller files. Perhaps use a WebM file type if you know anything about WebM. It's an open source video file type that is quite good because you can save all smaller files that have pretty high quality audio and video. I think it was Cindy, somebody uploaded something that was like almost a gigabyte. So, for whatever reason, Canvas is not, I thought it was, but I guess in the assignments, it's not set up to just stream from Canvas. I actually have to download your files, and so I don't want to have to download, 10 gigabytes of videos. So, my suggestion is to, first of all, you can read up on how to export video with WebM as a WebM file. You probably need a special video converter program to do that. You can also do it, you can actually do it. You can code it as a WebM file as well. It's probably easier if you convert it with some software. And you'll probably want to find some software that is open source. What's that?
I've been fighting with it for a week.
Oh, yeah? What probably have
it?
Is
it's
it?
Just like everything I've tried doesn't work on my Sierra, and I'm not looking to downgrade my operating system.
Yeah. Well, you could always just put it together with either GarageBand or iMovie. Is that a problem? Well, I think it's very heroic of you to stick with that clip. I mean, if I had a suggestion, I'd just choose a different clip.
Well, I did find another clip, okay. But
however you do it, it's best if it's not a huge file. So if you really just can't figure out a way to put the video together, you shouldn't have this problem with the file. No one's ever had a problem putting the final project together because the concepts inside the movies are all public domain, so there's not usually any trouble with processing them in video. If you have a new operating system, that might be a problem with open source software. Now, it's a problem sometimes with proprietary software as well. It's just that proprietary programs are usually more involved in upgrading and debugging their software for new operating systems. So that's more of a problem with open source things where you're kind of on your own. I don't think anybody's going to have trouble with the silent movies. If you do, then my suggestion is to, if you have a Macintosh, the best solution is to use a combination of GarageBand and iMovie. If you have a Windows computer, then I would suggest just looking up some free video production software. There are all sorts of programs available online. So Reaper should work for everybody, but if you're having some insurmountable problem, then just find some other software. In the case with the computation test and next assignment, I said that in worst case scenario, you can just send me a link to the clip and then send me some audio. So you'll have to say where the clip begins and ends and where the audio begins and ends as well. But it should be any problem that can't be solved the next assignment. Okay. Did you hear what I said about saving the file as a smaller, saving it as a smaller file?
No.
Okay, because I think somebody uploaded a really huge file, and my suggestion is to, you know, it doesn't have to be at the optimum quality. I suggested a WebM file instead of, say, a movie .mov file. Those are usually larger. WebM is a good product type for that. But, you know, try to get it under 200 megabytes, basically. It shouldn't be too hard to save a, you know, 2 or 3 minute clip in a file that's under 200 megabytes. Because I guess I have to download them from the Canvas website. It's just kind of a pain. I can't stream them from Canvas, apparently. Okay? Good. So, what we're going to do today is go through some examples of what happens when you synchronize video with different pieces of music, perhaps different soundtracks. See the way that the effect of the scene changes. And the change will be something that arises out of what, in your reading, the first author for the reading today calls the audio-visual contract. What he basically means by that is that when you watch a movie, we've already sort of seen this idea at play, but the idea is that film is at least as much an audio art form as it is a visual art form. But to say that it is as much a video art form is to sort of miss the point, because it's not that film is like a heap of different art forms that don't interact, that it's, you know, you're listening to a piece of music while you're watching something, but rather they interact in a very specific and interesting way. I've talked about it in relationship, say, to montage, thus far, where this idea that you have a sound and an image, and the contrast between them, what Michel Chion calls the audiovisual contrast, creates a synthetic meaning in our minds, a synthetic experience, perhaps. So that's one of the terms that he uses quite a lot in the chapter that we read for today, which we'll be discussing in a little bit more detail later on. One of the basic mechanisms, though, of the audiovisual contract that he identifies, which is something we've seen many, many times already, he gives it the name synchrosis. You may have seen this in the article. It's not a term that he defines in that chapter. But synchrosis is basically the way that music and sound can interact in sort of a specific way, such that events that happen aurally and events that happen visually at times seem to get stuck together or seem to get glued together in very interesting ways. And when you start to change the soundtrack, you'll start to see that whatever soundtrack you choose, there will be things that are happening in the visual track that seems to be somehow oddly synchronized with the video track. And it's not that you even necessarily need to plan it out that well, because this is very much related to one of the things I said in an earlier lecture about how if you take a sort of just naturalistic or perhaps evolutionary viewpoint about how we experience sound in the world, we tend to always experience sound as an effect of a cause, right? So you see a visual, and so sound is an effect of a visual cause in particular. So for any sound that you can imagine, except for one very interesting exception that I can think of, for the most part, every sound is always the effect of the motion that creates it. And so, if I clap my hands, for instance, we never have the sense that the sound caused the clap, right? It's just that the clap creates a sound. One of the things that's very interesting, so we were talking about, first of all, the fallacy of causality yesterday, and also the notion of backwards causality. One of the things that film allows you to do, however, interestingly enough, is actually create a sort of backward causality. One of the ways that you could do this, for instance, just in the example of clapping your hand, you could take the sound of the clap and stretch it out, maybe play it backwards or something, you know, reverse the sound, stretch it out, so that you have this crescendo that the endpoint of which is synchronized with the visual of me clapping, right? It's sort of a strange thing that's possible only in film as a technologically mediated contract between sound and images. And so synchronous is actually sort of a portmanteau or a combination of two different words. It's synchronization and synthesis. So like a synchronized synthesis. What is synthesized? What is sort of synthetically produced when you synchronize different things together? And in particular, when you synchronize different sounds and different images. So that's one of the things that you'll find is very interesting in the exercise that you undertake for next week. Now, one of the things about when you switch out the audio and you line it up with the video, one of the things that I said already is that you'll find that certain things that seem to just sort of be freely floating in the scene, images, motions that you see, at certain points, depending on which audio you put in, will somehow sort of be magnetized to auditory. And you'll see that for any piece of music you put in, there will be different visual events that seem to somehow be magnetized or glued to the sounds. Now, one of the things that's really interesting about this, I've done a few projects where I write a piece of music that's performed live, but it's together with silent film. And one of the things that happens, I've done this twice, is that, you know, the way that I write the piece is I watch the scene and I kind of think of some of the images and more or less the tempo and mood of the scene and that sort of thing. And then I just write the music. And what happens is that when you play whatever the music is, I mean, there are exceptions to this. It's quick you could write some music that is so absolutely in conflict or contradiction with the visual component of the scene that this doesn't work. But by and large, this works. Whatever music you write, there will be things in the visual aspect of the scene that seem to be synchronized with the music, such that audience members will always come up after performances and say, "How did you get it so that the sounds and the images were so perfectly synchronized?" And, usually I tell them that I'm just a brilliant artist. But the thing that's interesting about this is that it seems cognitively that we are so perhaps accustomed, or might be even that we have a sort of biological predisposition to combine sight and sound synthetically, that if you have, say, a sound and a motion, and they're not perfectly synchronized, you know, and you'll see, especially when you're doing the soundtrack for the final project, but even in this project, you'll see that, you know, it gets to the point where you're like, pushing things over like microcentimeters to get the alignment just right. But it's actually the case that if you're watching some sort of motion and you hear some sort of sound, I'm not sure exactly what the maximum distance is, but they can be even like about a second or more apart, and you'll still combine them. And it's a very strange situation where, you know, something will happen, a visual thing, and, you know, half a second later the sound will occur. And depending on the specificity of the sound, this doesn't work very well with speech, because speech has more than just an aural component. This is what, in the chapter, Michelle was referring to as the semantic way of listening, that there's a meaning laden or a meaning bearing dimension of speech as sound, which is more, has a greater degree of specificity than just sort of abstract sound, or, you know, the sound of, say, a car engine or this sort of thing. But particularly in the case of abstract sound, it doesn't have semantic content. The distance between the sight and the sound can be actually pretty far apart, and you still have the experience of them being somehow fused together, somehow connected. very interesting phenomenon. It's the sort of thing that in a really great, in the head of a really great filmmaker, David Lynch does this sometimes, although I don't think in Mulholland Drive he does this, but there are filmmakers that do this sort of thing where they create a sort of weird tension or even perhaps discomfort by misaligning sight and sound a little bit. It's a very interesting thing to do. But all of this is to say that the way that you combine sight and sound actually creates what another term creates a new synthetic value. This is what Michel Chagnon refers to as added value. The way that you take a piece of music that you experience, or not even a piece of music, just some sort of soundtrack, some collection of sounds, and you experience it in a certain way that might mean something to you. You take some visual component, and when you put them together, there's this added value that seems to somehow emerge from the contract, from the synthetic synchronization of sight and sound. So we're going to look at a couple examples of this that I prepared. Hopefully we won't have too much trouble with projection. Let's see. Jet's here. Okay. You're here. Okay. Yeah. Where am I? What's this? Let me get my playlist up here. 325. Yeah, well, okay. Don't worry about that song called Dog Butt. Maybe I'll play it. why is that playing? That's strange. Okay. Let me see here. Ah, yes. Let's start with this. The Shining plus sappy music. See what happens. So, one thing I'll say,
we're still going to try to analyze the scene visually and aurally in terms of some of the formal characteristics. This is actually something important that I didn't say yet, so maybe I'll turn on the lights and just say a few more words about this.
It's not just that music adds meaning to a scene, or that, you know, there's a synthetic meaning that arises out of music and images or sound and images. But also on a formal level, it's really important to think about what's going on. The way that your experience of time is altered by the soundtrack, or the way your experience of time is altered by the visuals, perhaps. I mean, you know, the easiest way to imagine this is just to take two really contrasting examples. So, you know, you have a scene of a lot of vigorous warfare, or some, you know, a fight scene, or you know, some kind of thing where you have a lot of quick cutting, and you put a slower soundtrack, a very slow piece of music to it. Quite often, you have a sense of time moving more slowly. Although I will say that it's usually the case that that works better if you have a lot of action. So actual motion within the shot is, you know, quite active. And you put a slow piece of music, it'll seem like things somehow slow down. I think it's less the case that if you're having a lot of rapid cuts, that a slow piece of music will actually create a sense of slowness. And I think the reason is that when you are cutting very quickly, it's creating sort of this illusion of motion on a formal level. Right. It's just that the images, the individual images, are changing more rapidly. And it's a little bit harder for a piece of music to sort of smooth that over or glue that together. And so I think generally, if you have a lot of fast, rapid cuts, like say in the formal command scene, and a slow piece of music, you probably get the sense of it, of something being a little bit wrong. If you had a really static piece of music, then it might work. But if you have a slow piece of music that has a clear meter, but it's just very slow, very relaxed. I think you just kind of feel like there's something wrong, like the scene doesn't work, like it's not coming together somehow. But in the case of a single shot with a lot of motion within it, the piece of music could actually create a sense of a sort of slower passage of time because it's not in conflict with the rhythm of the cutting. And especially if it is like a crowd scene where in the case of crowds, both aurally and visually, there tends to be this effect whereby we distribute the motion in a way that sort of distributes our attention more broadly instead of focusing on a particular motion, right? So, for instance, one of the things you'll find when you do the final project, let's say you have a crowd scene, you can take any scene of a crowd and plug it into a crowd. It doesn't, all crowds basically sound the same because our attention is distributed such that we're not paying attention to the rhythms of any particular sound that's being produced. And it's very similar if you have some kind of image with a lot of motion and, say, a really slow piece of music. So you can imagine like a battle scene or like, you know, imagine a scene in a Star Wars type movie where you've got a bunch of ships that are all flying around and this sort of thing, and then you have some very slow music that'll sound sort of like a memory or this sort of thing, but you won't have the sense that the scene just doesn't work. And it has to do with the way that we distribute our attention when there's a lot of stuff competing for our attention versus when there's just one thing that we're focusing on. And in the case of speech with a crowd, as I said, you can plug any sound of the crowd in. In the case of one person speaking, it's going to be extremely obvious if the language does not match what's being spoken. Except with cartoons, actually. Without cartoons, it's kind of interesting. Cartoons always look like they're speaking whatever language is done on top of them. It's sort of strange, but it's very much the case. So, that's one other thing, or perhaps one other way to think about the combination of sight and sound, or as Michel Chion says, the audio-visual contract. And so, in each of the scenes that we're going to watch, that's one thing to think about. So, how does that combination operate formally and functionally? And how does it operate in terms of semantic content? And then, perhaps, how does it operate in terms of mood? I think in the case of semantic content, it gets really interesting. What do you think the music seems to say about the inner states of the characters and their motivations? And how does that change the meaning of the scene, for instance? Okay.
All right. Hopefully we have sound. Go back 1 second here. I don't hear sound coming out, so is that on? That's on. Well, we did have sound a second ago. Let's see. I wonder if there's something wrong with the way I exported this. Well, there's no sound coming out of there. What did I do wrong? That's got sound. Let me make sure that we have sound coming out here. No? There you go. Well, yeah, that's... Okay, there must be something that I did wrong with my exporting of that scene. So maybe we'll move on to the next one, and I'll see if I can figure this other one out. What's that?
Aladdin is a jerk.
Oh, yeah. Aladdin is a jerk, yeah. Well, we could watch this for a second. Sometimes I used to use this when I talk about the vector of time or the directionality of time, but that's not something that I'm really theorizing in this class this time. But you'll get the idea if you watch this scene. Y'all know the Disney movie Aladdin, if you've seen it. There's a great GIF that I found that all it does is reverse the video, but you get a completely different meaning out of the scene by doing this. Hopefully this will work.
Oh, Yeah. All right. Now let's see. Hopefully this other clip that I set up will work. If not, then I'll just have to figure out a different fix. Where did it go? Where's my stuff here? Let's see if we have this one. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We have sound here. That's good. All right. Yeah. Actually, it might be sort of interesting. I'd like to first show you my version of it before showing you the original. But how many people have seen Requiem for a Dream? If everybody's seen it, then only one. Raise your hand high enough for me to see. Okay, only one person. So we'll watch my scene first, and then we'll watch the original. Okay. And all those questions that I laid out are still in force. The functional, formal, and perhaps semantic or emotional changes in the scene. Here we go.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I've seen blue, to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark same night, and I think to myself,
things I noticed about projecting from my computer is it's really dark, so hopefully it was possible to see everything that's going on there. Why don't we just remember what you just saw, and I'll play the original version now. Let's see. Let's see, 113 or so. There we go. It's right here. Okay. Thank you.
straight, and bright, and beach, Brooklyn, please give a juicy welcome to Mrs.
Could you all see when the guy in blue turns on his side as like the thing that pops up on the right side of the screen? Could anybody tell what that was? No? Okay. Yeah, it's too dark. I'm surprised I didn't know it was that dark. That's why I've been playing things from my... I don't think that changes the... I don't think that changes the projector. That's why I've been playing movies from the DVD, because it's way too dark to see me. It would have been much more effective if you could really see what was going on. He's imagining himself as a child and being cradled in his mother's arms. And I love when I pop in the Louis Armstrong there. He's like, I watch babies grow. So we'll see how well this works. Trying to analyze the change in the scene, considering it's kind of hard to see a lot of what's going on. But yeah, let's start with some of those questions that I raised. And I don't have my phone with me, so I'll just use my institutional power and call on people as I see fit. So Alec, why don't you start talking?
Okay, I will start talking. So the difference between that I saw between the two films was that one gave, so the Louis Armstrong one versus, I like sort of laughed when I heard the first beginning of it. It's like the Louis Armstrong one seemed like more reminiscent of the past, and this one seemed more inspirational and like powerful.
The second one seemed more inspirational?
Then
It's a Wonderful World?
Then It's a Wonderful, not inspirational. What is the word that I'm looking for? Driving.
Yeah, okay.
That's the word.
I think that's
what
you're
saying, driving.
I think driving is a more neutral term, certainly. I mean, they're both about the same tempo.
There's
a big difference, though, in terms of the rhythm. In Louis Armstrong, it has a light swing, so that instead of it being sort of really precise and even rhythms, it's more like
it's a slow swing
thing, whereas this is very mechanical, and so you know that's sort of interesting. I mean, how did that influence the scene on a formal level? That's maybe more interesting to talk about. I mean, the emotional things are a little obvious. I will say before we get away from the emotional content of this, I really hate this scene in the original movie. Mostly because I think the music is so bad.
Yeah.
So incredibly bad. One of the reasons that I think the music is bad, objectively so, is that it's trying, well, I don't know if the music is bad, but the choice of the music is bad. Darren Aronofsky is the guy who directed this. He's actually a pretty interesting director. I don't know if any of you saw his recent one called Mother! Exclamation point.
Now, how was that?
It was okay. I mean, it was overstated. Not quite as overstated as Requiem for a Dream, but it was a little bit of, like, do you get the deep symbolism? Like, you know, shoving the deep symbolism down your throat every chance. It was a little annoying. But, you know, this scene has many different aspects in it. And we could talk about it emotionally. I want to hear some accounts about how changing music works formally, but one of the things you said was this sort of, it seems like the music using Louis Armstrong does this sort of nostalgic or reminiscent quality out of the scene, which means that it's not all bad, it's not all, you know, sad and, just utter degradation and sorrow and that sort of thing. That there is a certain, I mean, all the characters smile in the scene. Except for the guy in the jumpsuit, I guess. But he's remembering being cradled in his mother's arms instead of smiling. So, you know, there's always some sort of positive image there. And this music is extremely one-dimensional on many different levels. It's one-dimensional because of the fact that the harmony is basically one chord the whole time. But the melody is so banal. If you remember the melody, da 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 da
da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da
da
da da da actually gave more meaning to the...
Well, here's the thing. We've established that we saw the original that they're crying. But I don't think that's obvious from what we see.
Yeah.
And in fact, with Louis Armstrong, even when I watch it now, even knowing what happens, and probably many people in this room have the same experience, what do you think the Louis Armstrong music drew out of the scene where the two women meet their... meet the other woman? We don't know what the relationship is, but did it seem grim or did it seem kind of hopeful? I guess it's a little bit hard to see the scene because it's so dark and you can't really see people's faces. But the woman who you might have surmised is in like a mental institution has a very sort of neutral face on. She's just like non-expressive at all. And it really, when you know, I'll put this up on the canvas page so you can see it in a little bit better clarity. But it really does seem like it's kind of like these two women who haven't seen their old friend in a long time and are, you know, just like this moment where, my God, I finally found my old friend. That's kind of a change.
She's still like in an institutional setting and she's clearly a patient. And
yeah, well, I would say that, but I mean, you know that because you've seen the movie. I'm not sure that just from that scene it's clear. Maybe once you sleep, you sit on the bed, maybe. But even there, you know, with her flashback, so to speak, flashback, with the Louis Armstrong music, did it seem like a paranoid delusion, or, you know, some kind of delusion, or did it seem like a happy number? Yeah, right?
Yeah.
But it's quite clear in the movie that it's a paranoid delusion. I think with this music, it also sort of seems like paranoid illusion or some sort of illusion, because it's so in such tension with the mood that the music is conveying. But what I will say about the two women hugging, because what we see is, you know, the woman, she goes like that. We don't know why she's so like, there's so much gravity in the fat woman's face, and then we see the skinny woman, she had a kind of neutral, non-emotional face. And the next thing we see are two women hugging. How many people knew who the two women were that were hugging? Was it the two people that were at the table, or was it the woman who looked into the face of the friend, hugging the friend? You know, it's a little bit unclear, and I think it's actually extremely unclear what the mood of that is. And you'll notice that in the original, the only sound effects that they dub anywhere, it's all just music the whole time, the only sound effects that they dub in are the sounds of sobs at that moment, just to make sure that we all know that they're crying. That's one of the reasons I hate that scene. It would probably be better to play it a little bit more ambiguously, you know, to, maybe not Louis Armstrong, but something that gets at the ambiguity of the situation instead of, like, you know, slamming our faces in the pavement of what the movie means, you know. So that's an interesting addition, because that's a very specific post-production decision that the director probably made. Or maybe the producer, you know, somebody who didn't think that the scene was obvious enough. Well, let's make sure everybody knows they're crying, right? Instead of letting the scene either be ambiguous or somehow communicating the abjection or the sadness of the scene in some more sophisticated, interesting, and maybe multivalent way. But the question about the formal influence, the way that the music seems to perhaps alter the scene in terms of the rhythm of the scene or the passage of time, would anybody like to take a stab at that? Why don't you choose somebody? Sorry.
Sure.
you might not know everybody's name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Jet, you have been called on.
What was the question?
Well, that's probably why you shouldn't sit in the back and probably not be doing other work on your computer during class. I would suggest that you might want to be more involved in the discussion, especially since participation is part of it, which so the question was how the music, the change, seems to influence the formal aspects of the scene, say the way that time seems to flow, the rate of the flow of time, the rhythm of the scene, if there's any thing that you might want to say about the two different pieces of music and whether that influences that aspect of the scene.
Maybe like the tempo was distinct, more distinct than the first one.
Oh, so, well, first of all, the tempo, which tempo? There are three possible things you could mean by tempo. The tempo of the visual track, the tempo of the audio track, or the combined tempo of both together?
The transparent tempo, so both.
Oh, I see. Okay, so would you like to try to spell that out a little bit more? Why do you think that's the case?
I'll have to get back to you on that.
You'll have to get back to me, okay. Well, why don't you not sit there? I know you have to leave a little bit earlier. Why don't you sit over here? And maybe I'll get a little bit more involved in the front of the class. All right, well, anybody else? Well, you seem pretty eager to answer that question.
I want to see, the Louis Armstrong, the swing, made it seem the rhythm of the entire, of the both music, and just because of the music of Louis Armstrong, it makes it feel like it's a lullaby, kind of, or like dreamy, rather than like the driving, the mechanical sort of thing. It sort of makes it, it actually makes it seem faster with the,
Really?
Yeah, it makes it, it feels like it's laid back and chill, rather than the original, which is more like, I want to get to the end of it. I feel rushed when I'm watching it.
I see. But you see, which one did you say made it feel like it goes faster?
The original.
The original makes it seem like it goes faster.
Yeah.
And I can see what you mean, because it's like the music is timed to the rhythm of the scene so that it swells and like the highest point in that melodic phrase occurs at the, you know, the moment where this emotional thing is revealed, but then...
What's the emotional thing? Let's try to be more specific. What's the emotional thing?
Well, like, the scene in the first part where the two friends are in the waiting room and Vince wants to ensure she comes out, but you don't see her at first.
Mm-hmm.
But in that scene, the music kind of hits its high point when you first see her face.
So you know it's going to be a big reveal.
Every time it's such a scene. And then it doesn't give you time to process that, because the moment in the next scene, and you know that you're coming up to some other climax, and so you have to get ready for it, so you don't need to process what just happened. You know you have to get ready, you know the music is coming, you better stop thinking about that, because something else is coming up here, you better be ready for it. So you just kind of hurry through it.
Yeah, you know, that's a very interesting way to describe that, especially the idea that you better stop thinking about what just happened, because now there's another thing, it's like punch after punch. I mean, that's the way that most Hollywood narrative cinema works, that it just continually distracts you with some new spectacle, something that's happening. This is related a little bit to what we were talking about in suture theory, about how getting immersed in the... In the film itself, in its various, the music or the storytelling of the film seems, in a way, to cycle critical thought, to cycle analytical, or even just the notion that ambiguity is one possible to possibly a good thing, to sort of, I suppose, depending on how we think about this scene functioning, I mean, maybe that's, there's a way that you could kind of read this scene as being an example of the sort of therapy that one might find in a state institution. You know, that there's something about it that is very invasive. forcible subduing of patients or something. There's something about the scene that seems very much like that, which, in a way, is kind of interesting, because all of the, well, except for the the woman. But one person that we didn't see in this scene who has his arm cut off and is in a hospital. I guess, I don't know why he has his arm cut off. Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Everybody, I couldn't even remember
what happened to him.
Well, they're all drug addicts, and the black guy gets sent to prison. The woman, for whatever reason, turns into like a live porn actress or something. And the woman is the mother of the first character who we didn't see, and she's just insane. So they all end up in some bad situation. And the first guy, what we see is that he's in a hospital, and his left arm has been amputated, but I can't remember why they have to. I think it has something to do with like injecting heroin and getting an effect.
Oh, yeah. He's so angry.
Basically, most of the characters end up in some very repressive institution of some sort. And perhaps there's something about the scene that seems a little bit repressive. Like what you were saying, where it's like it doesn't even let you think about the situation because of how perhaps driving and even one-dimensional it is. The music is one-dimensional. There are certain, like, I think that the dubbing, the sobbing over the scene is one-dimensional. But there's maybe an interesting way we could read it. Now, what we might do is, if you know the movie, you could do something where instead of reading what the movie seems to actually be saying or what it thinks it's saying, to find a way to almost sort of like psychoanalyze the movie, that is, put together an analysis that reads against the grain. And so one of the things that you could say is that, look, the film is trying to give us a picture of how institutional power, institutional therapy is this really oppressive thing. But isn't it interesting that it traffics in the same sorts of messaging or same sorts of rhetoric, perhaps, that the institutions that it's criticizing seem to make use of? And so we could find a way to sort of like, almost like psychoanalyze the authors of the film and actually like, so the driving music, it doesn't even let you think for a second. It seems like on a first dimensional level of analysis that what the scene is about is that it's kind of just like, really obviously supposed to be kind of a sad scene, right? But then at the same time, it seems to be sad in this very one-dimensional, perhaps even mildly oppressive way that seems to actually be in agreement with the thing that it's criticizing, this institutional power of the hospital, the insane asylum, and the prison, you know. So that's something that's quite interesting. I think with Louis Armstrong, it's a little bit more ambiguous. I don't think it's terribly much more ambiguous. I think what's interesting about the visual component of the scene is that it's not nearly as one-dimensional as the music. And the music kind of forces the scene into a straitjacket that is perhaps not adequate for what's really going on visually. And so I would say two better pieces of music. All right. Maybe we'll... I've done that before. I haven't done it in years. Were you high?
Yeah.
It doesn't work in this room.
It does work.
Well, I guess if you're sleep deprived, it also kind of works. Everything starts to make sense. Right, because there are certain. But there are many different conflicting theories on where to start the music, right?
Third line war,
is that what
they mean? Yeah. Like at the beginning of that MGM, the line war should be on the third war.
Yeah.
Right.
We're talking about the Wizard of Oz again. If you've not seen the Wizard, you know, it's sort of interesting how. I don't know, maybe we do have shared cultural currency, but it very often seems like, it used to be the case that everybody read, you know, a lot of books and that sort of thing, and then people used to get upset about how people don't read books anymore, and our shared culture is in movies. But now it doesn't even seem to be the case that we have a shared cinematic culture, because how many people have seen The Wizard of Oz? Yeah, so put it together with Dark Side of the Moon and see what magic happens. Now, I wanted to see if I can make my Shining clip work, because I have it at least in GarageBand, although I don't know if I saved the project, so we might just have to put it up online for you to see. But it's kind of interesting to do the same sort of thing with The Shining. Let's see if I can access it in GarageBand. I don't think I can, because I didn't save it. Well, that's fine. I'll just leave it at that. I think that that at least gives you a pretty good idea of the sorts of things to write about in the written component. I think we all basically just intuitively can think of a good clip and good, you know, alternate music to put down. I'm not too worried about that. The thing that's a little bit more difficult is how to theorize it. So, again, just to sum up the various things that we were talking about, this idea of added value and synchrosis, the way that sound and images work together to create this synthetic contract, this synthetic meaning that arises out of their interplay. That functions on a variety of different levels. It functions formally in terms of the rhythm or the passage of time. It functions semantically in terms of what the scene means. It functions emotionally, the various moods that seem to be suggested. And then finally, think about how you can analyze the scene by virtue of the change in the music. Is there something about some sort of course of properties about the scene that seem to hold up, even if you change the music? Or does the music really redefine the scene entirely? That's another way to think about that question. All right. So I'd like to move into sort of a lecture. It's a little bit less formal this time than the previous few lectures. But we're going to be talking about musique complète today, do you have a loop?
Yeah, sure.
All right, well, read about musique complète on your own, because it will be on the next quiz. So, all right. Okay. So we're going to talk about musique complète, but in the meantime, before we get to that, I'd like to, sort of as a segue from 2001, talk about silence. And actually, I need a piano. I don't know what happened to our piano. Let me see if there's a piano. What?
Somebody else showed a movie in here earlier today.
Showed a movie?
Well,
I don't know. I wonder why.
There was a bunch of people in here that were talking about the movie.
The movie.
The movie?
Yeah.
I wonder if it was my PA who sometimes taught science class. All right. I think there should be a piano back here. Alright. Can somebody help me carry a stool, perhaps?
Yeah.
Someone take the piano out of the stage. Mentioned a piece by John Cage called "For Me 32 Seconds," and a few of you, actually most of you, are not familiar with the piece. So I thought that maybe one way to introduce it to you would be to perform an excerpt from it. So something that I've been practicing some time. Years of my life have been devoted to this, and that's not a joke. here is the first movement of "For Me 32 Seconds." perception in that. That was about a minute and 40 seconds or so. Perhaps it even seemed a little bit longer, perhaps. The passage of time seemed to elongate or something like that. But what can we say about the sorts of things that we perceive in that time span? What did you notice about, first of all, was it silent? So what did you hear?
I guess from the speakers.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, being hyper aware of any noises that I'm making.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The creak of the stage.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's sort of interesting because we're talking about the sounds as specific. Like, it was that creak of the stage, it was that hiss from those loudspeakers. But we're going to describe the piece that we heard in terms of the form, in terms of maybe like the narrative there. If you're going to describe it in terms of not necessarily an arc, but some sort of trajectory, some sort of change in our perceptual state over that period. Is there anything, can you say that your experience seemed to change at all over the minute or so, minute and a half of that movement? So you're nodding vigorously.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you nodding?
So as I was listening to the piece, like, it's very interesting how, like, it didn't feel like a minute and 40 seconds. It felt like a lifetime within that. I think it's also...
Well, that's an interesting point. We'll mark that, because I want to ask you about that.
Sure.
But later, go on to the next thing about this.
Yeah, I think it's partially because... I think it was a really good exercise, because, like, a lot of the times, like, music and, like, anything else, it's, like, something that keeps you entertained.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not exactly for entertainment. This is, like, there's an entertainment value in it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you're, like, a lot of people, like, their first initial reaction is, which is silence. There is nothing. But there is something.
Yeah, so I would say that this piece is a little bit weird. And that's why I think it's so important to actually perform it. It's really important to perform it for two main reasons. The main reason is that it's really an extremely experiential piece. One thing, the piece is completely different every time in terms of the content, the material of the piece. But also, the piece is really about actually hearing the sounds that you're hearing. You can't abstract it in the way that you can abstract, say, Beethoven's symphony, and talk about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony apart from its performances and still have this idea that it's one thing. Notice the way that we talk about symphonies this way, which is very strange, because certainly there's an idea that performances are different, but we have this idea that nonetheless a piece of music is a thing that somehow exists regardless of its performance, so that if you have a bad performance, there's still this idea that there's some ideal, I guess, non-spatio-temporal piece that somehow exists outside of its performances. Another way to describe that is to say, you know, to talk about a piece of music, or even a film for that matter, as a thing, is a really weird practice. Because what happens is we experience a piece of music, right? We hear the vibrations, we hear the harmonies, at least what we conceptualize to be harmonies. But somehow we're able to talk about it as a thing, as having relationships, so that you talk about the beginning and the end of the symphony as having this some almost like a spatial relationship. And if you ever take a music theory class, you'll see that people will draw diagrams of symphonies, you draw a narrative arc of a movie, right? And you'll show how, like in Vertigo, this corresponds to this. But whenever you're doing that, what you're doing is taking something that is in first order experience and maybe even necessarily time-based, temporal, and somehow taking it outside of time. Right? And so that you're thinking about the movie or the piece of music somehow not as a succession of experiences, but somehow as this thing that exists simultaneously. One of the things I was talking about the other day was this idea of this traditional notion of truth as somehow existing outside of time. This is that basic idea applied to narrative, applied to music, wherein we're talking about the formal structure, the balance, the unity, the perhaps even meaning of a piece of music, of a narrative, somehow as existing simultaneously, instead of thinking of it as actually just being a series of events. This is something you can't really do with Horman's 33 seconds. I mean, it has a name, so we can name the piece. We can say Horman's 33 seconds, but every performance of Horman's 33 seconds is entirely different, at least in terms of its content. And so what that shows is that it's one approach to music that is experiential and not on the first order level abstract or formal, that it's really about the experience and not necessarily even the understanding. The other thing about the piece and why I think it's so important to be performed is that it has a very obvious shock element in it. You know, I've sort of been leading up to it because I've been talking about silence and so on, but you can imagine a concert where you have a series of more or less regular pieces where people are playing music, and then the next piece is this thing where the pianist lifts up the lid and instead of playing, just sits there. And so one of the things that's interesting about the piece, I think, is the way that the shock of, like, well, this, you might, I think that the shock is actually temporally prior to thinking that the piece is just done. You know, it's sort of like, ugh, what the, this doesn't make any sense, therefore it's dumb, I don't understand it, therefore it's stupid. But I think that that's one way of I suppose, interpreting that experience of shock. But I think another way of experiencing the shock is that it kind of, in a way, awakens you to all of the things that you're capable of perceiving that you just don't pay attention to, generally. And, you know, I've done this piece, or the first movement of the piece, many times, and this actually is the first time that I've done it that there wasn't a lot of sound outside, which is sort of interesting, because usually what happens is you feel like a car drive by an airplane or something like that. And there you can actually talk very succinctly about almost like a formal narrative, even though it's chance, you know, it's just by pure luck, whatever sounds happen to take place in that time span. Nonetheless, you can say that first the piece seems silent, and then you heard the low sound outside, and then you heard the low rumbling of your belly, and you realize that actually these sounds are connected, this sort of thing. But this time it was very silent, much more silent than usual. And I also heard a sort of hiss. I don't think it's only the loudspeakers. I think that it's probably also the ventilation and there's some other airflow in the room. But one of the things that I noticed was that I know that it didn't actually get louder, but my experience of it was that it got more and more present, this sort of hissing, and I became more and more aware of it, and I started to become more and more aware of how much detail I could actually hear. Because at first it just sort of seemed like, well, silent, like nothing's going on. And then I perceived this distinct sort of high-pitched sound. But then what I started to notice is that the more I sort of listened in, I could perceive a really pretty wide band of sounds that's taking place, which is sort of interesting. It means that in that time span, my perception was the thing that seemed to be developing, not necessarily the material of the piece of music. Now, this piece was born out of an experience that the composer John Cage had. He writes about this as a famous anecdote, in which he goes to this place on the campus of Harvard University. It's a room known as an anechoic chamber, a chamber with no echoes. A room that, because there's no reverberation at all in the room, should be completely silent, if there's nothing making noise in it. And what Cage does is he goes into the room and he sits there for a long time. And I've never had this experience, but you can go on YouTube and like find local news reports where like a reporter goes into an anechoic chamber and it's like this life-changing experience, you know, to be in the most quiet room possible. It's kind of very interesting. But according to the story that John Cage tells us, he goes into the room. And after a while, even though the room is supposed to be completely silent, he distinctly perceives two sounds. One is a very high-pitched sound, and one is a very low-pitched sound. And he goes out afterwards and asks the engineer who's responsible for maintaining the room, you know, it's supposed to be silent, but I heard these two sounds quite distinctly. And the engineer explains that the low sound was the sound of the circulatory system, and the high sound was the sound of the central nervous system. So what he draws on that is that we necessarily experience sound in the world. We experience vibrations. What he says about that is that we need not fear for the future of music, because there will always be sound. But one of the things that's interesting about this is that, one, there is no such thing as silence. What there is, well, I mean, I suppose there is silence, but we can't actually experience it. Because even if you went into space or something, you wouldn't actually be able to experience the silence, because you'd have to be in a pressurized suit, you know? So that, what?
That suit, the noise in that suit.
Yeah, the noise in that suit, right?
The noise in that suit is very scuba, like, you know,
yeah.
the long, sustained breathing, even like little clacking with the krill, when you're underwater and you can hear all the little...
I've never had scuba diving.
Oh, when you hear snorkeling, you can also hear it snorkeling.
I see.
But, sorry.
But that should have been krill in space, right?
Right.
Space krill.
Sort of sound in the background of his hiss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the hiss, I'm not sure what the hiss was. It might have been like the pressurization, or it might have been like something to regulate body temperature or something. I don't know. But yeah, certainly. The point is that silence is not something that we can experience. And this, in a way, gets to the sort of idea that we were describing in terms of representation, theories of representation, wherein, well, I suppose in space there literally is no sound vibration, and yet that's not something we can experience or necessarily experience sound. But if you say 33 seconds, or I suppose even the moments of silence in 2001, are very interesting, because at first, what we think is, oh, this piece is silent, nothing happens. But then what we realize is that it projects the sound back onto us. And what happens is we become very aware of the sounds around us. And there are different ways to experience that. I mean, you can experience it as tedious and a waste of time, you know, to follow along some of the ideas in the Nietzsche lecture from yesterday, perhaps, because it's getting in the way of you most efficiently fulfilling your goals, for instance, right? That sort of idea that it's about nothing somehow seems like a waste of time. But another way to experience it is to come into sort of an aesthetic appreciation of the sounds around you, of the sounds that you typically ignore on a day-to-day basis. But notice, one of the things that's interesting about a performance is 33 seconds, and why it's so important for it to be performed instead of explained, experienced or expressed instead of explained, the following Nietzsche, is that it's precisely because the piece uses the conventions of concert culture, concert etiquette, and subverts them, but it's still reliant on those conventions. It's reliant on your expectations of what's going to happen when a pianist walks out on stage, lifts up the piano lid, and is about to play, and then... And notice, even if I'm giving a lecture and I stop, you have that same sort of rupture. It's very interesting. And it's that rupture, that sort of like aha moment, where you're sort of brought out of the lull, that the sort of lull that, you know, the music and Requiem for a Dream seems to put us in, right? This sort of rupture in our everyday experience of the world, our goal-oriented problem-solving experience of the world, that actually allows us to enter into a relationship with the sounds wherein we can actually experience them in the fullness. And in many ways, Nietzsche presages some of the things that were happening in 20th century art and music. But in particular, in the case of Cage, I think this idea, you know, very often, just like Nietzsche, people who don't really get what Cage was doing talk about him as basically being a nihilistic composer, a composer that just nihilistically renounces all values. That's certainly not the case, and it's not the case with Nietzsche as well. I mean, Nietzsche actually specifically was worried about the problem of nihilism, about people not actually believing that there is such a thing as, you know, communal values or any values to speak of whatsoever. In fact, Nietzsche is famously, I don't know if credited is quite the right word, but he's often seen as having more or less foreseen the sorts of crimes against humanity that took place in the 20th century. And the reason is because what he sees happening is that in secular society, what we have is a situation in which we no longer have a big picture. All we have is a question mark. But if all we have is a question mark, then what are our values grounded in? It used to be in traditional society, not only, you know, in religion, that values were grounded in ideas of God and what God tells us to do, but also values were grounded in communities. Values were grounded in family constellations. And one of the things that you see happening in 19th century industrialized culture is the breakdown of various communities, the breakdown of the church, the breakdown of the family as an actual sort of political entity. So that, you know, many people have the experience, and this is even more the case when children were forced into labor in factories in the 19th century. Now children live at home, you know, so it's perhaps a little bit less of a problem. But even so, even today, many of us have an experience of not really being connected to a community. And I think that that's really palpable in a place like Seattle. In fact, Seattle is very famous for having a lot of driven individuals that don't think about anything other than work. You know? And then the idea of the Seattle Freeze, right? But all these individuals that somehow have this extreme difficulty of forming a community. And this is the sort of thing that Nietzsche saw happening. And what he sees as a possible outcome of this is that if you no longer have some basic grounding as far as what is somehow just, I guess, maybe logically ethical or logically moral, the logically good thing to do, the universally good thing to do, then you're in a situation in which basically you have the cliche of might making right. And so one of the problems that you have, say, in contemporary ethical philosophy is, how do you, if you don't have some basic grounding like God or religion or divine commands, some divine entity telling you what the good thing to do is, then how do you ground morality at all? And there are various ways to try to do that, but one of the things that you see happening is this idea that, well, morality is just whatever the values of whoever happens to be in charge set up a society, set up a social picture, and that's the thing that is taken to be the right thing to do. So that, for instance, who is to say that if the Nazis had won the Second World War, this is a very extreme example, and there are many arguments against this, but if the Nazis had won the Second World War, and in fact had actually, even beyond that, conquered every country on Earth, and every country had a Nazi government, and Nazi belief system, then would that mean that the atrocities that took place in the Second World War were not immoral? Is that, or is it that those actions actually are somehow objectively immoral? Most of us want to say, well, there's got to be some way that you could make the argument that what they did is just bad, it's just wrong. Even if nobody on Earth believes that it was wrong, it's still wrong. But what Nietzsche sees happening is, if you get rid of some sort of grounding to the values, what happens if you have nihilism taking hold, wherein nobody believes that there are such things as actual grounded values, objective values, such that the Holocaust could be seen maybe even as a morally laudatory thing, a morally good thing, if you have a picture where might makes right, if everybody on Earth had been brought up in a Nazi society and had been conditioned to believe that that was the right thing to do, then you have a pretty big problem. This is the problem that Nietzsche saw already in the 19th century, and it's the problem of nihilism. It's the problem of not having any values. But as you remember, at the very least, one of the things that we saw is that Nietzsche has this idea that already in the appreciation of beauty, already in aesthetic experience, there seems to be something irreducibly good about life, even though it's painful, even though it doesn't maybe have a big cosmic big picture, there's something irreducibly good about life, even including all the painful moments in life. I think that John Cage, on a somewhat, you know, less grand scale than Nietzsche, has many of the same things to tell us, because quite often Cage is thought of as being a basically nihilistic composer. All he wanted to do was break down traditional values and, you know, have pieces of music where either complete garbage or just complete silence take place and somehow call that art as though there's no objective standard of quality in art. But I don't think that's actually the case. Well, I don't know that there is an objective standard for quality in art. That's a pretty big question to ask. But I don't think it's the case that Cage believes that there are no values, because Cage clearly believes and shows us that experiencing the world in its fullness is irreducibly valuable. Experiencing all the sounds around us that we usually ignore because they don't fit into our goals and plans and such things actually is irreducibly good, irreducibly valuable. And there's something about aesthetic experience that is just, for no other reason except that it is like you say, pleasurable or meaningful, or maybe the best word is satisfying in some sense, that's irreducibly good. But notice, also in the case of Cage, it's specifically the old values of concert culture that can then somehow be reevaluated, twisted around, so that we have a completely new experience of the world around us in the piece of 32 seconds. Now,
are there stage directions for?
Not exactly stage directions. All it says is that there's like a paragraph at the beginning. So there's actually a score to this piece, which is sort of interesting. It's a published score. The published score, basically, there are three movements, and each movement is a set amount of time. And all it says is pass it, and then the amount of time you're supposed to sit there. And at the beginning, there's a paragraph that basically says what you're supposed to do, which is to walk out to the piano and raise the lid at the beginning of each movement and close it at the end of each movement. So that's all that there is in terms of directions.
Does it say, what to do with your hands?
Nope. And in fact, that's actually, it's very rare that you actually see a performance of this piece. Whenever you do see a performance of this piece, usually people try to gum it up in some way do things that aren't actually part of the idea of the piece, turn it into something more theatrical than it should be. The idea really is that the silence is a mirror back onto us, right? And it's not that we're supposed to sit there and watch like zany antics of the cast. I will say that Cage was not the only one and not the first one to write a silent piece. There are other silent pieces from the 20th century, or even Cage's. Cage's piece, I think, was written in 1955, 54, something, mid-50s. There's a piece by a German composer named Evan Schulhoff. It's called In Paradiso. And it's an extremely elaborate, complex-looking score with lots of different rhythms, but all of the rhythms are rests instead of notes. But the rhythms are all really difficult and complex, but they're all rests. That would be, I think, a somewhat different sort of idea, because there, the silence isn't so much of a mirror back on us, but rather you're watching this silent piece that actually has some content on stage. I think really the idea of permanent 33 seconds is that, you go into a very conventional, very familiar experience, and it becomes defamiliarized through the silence. But the silence is actually then, in a way, reflecting our own awareness and perception of the world around us. And I think this happens very much in 2001 as well. There's a lot more going on screen, and there's also a justification, a narrative justification for the silence, which kind of is at odds with what Cage is doing. I mean, it's kind of sad, actually. The DVD of 2001 has a bunch of bonus material where various actors and filmmakers are talking about the film. And by and large, nobody has anything very interesting to say. It's all about, how floating pen in the Pan Am scene in space, they, glued it to a glass screen. It's that kind of stuff. And then everybody's like, it was so brilliant that Kubrick actually made space silent. You know, and that's what's at odds with what Cage is doing. There's a reason for it. There's a justification. It's like, oh, it makes sense because this is a very realistic presentation of physical reality. But if you experience it not in terms of explanation, but in terms of expression or experience, then what you'll see is that actually it's very interesting because the moments of silence are kind of a weird marker in the experience of viewing a film where, you know, I was talking about this in terms of Eisenstein and his use of montage, but I think it's even more clear in Kubrick, where you really become very aware of watching the movie once the sound cuts out. You know, you're very aware of sitting in this space, having this experience, where when there's sound, you can be very much caught up in the spectacle, or the word that one of the authors that we've read so far, Theodore Adorno, uses is phantasmagoria, this sense of being immersed in a film or in artwork to the extent that you sort of lose sight of the fact that it's a creative product, that there's an apparatus that is telling you the story. I was talking about the way that in, say, Soviet realism, the apparatus gets hidden and you just sort of get immersed in the film. When the apparatus, or some very important element of the apparatus, the soundtrack, gets taken out, I don't think there's anybody in this room that wasn't very aware of just being in the space, watching some of the weirdness of, and the almost sort of nakedness that you feel. Luckily, there's a black room, so we can't see each other, but still, there's this sense of somehow being exposed, I think, when suddenly the film gets silent for, you know, it's only 30 seconds at a time as well, which is not even as much as is the case with 30 seconds. But again, it's this weird sort of rupture wherein you become very aware of the sounds around you. And in the case of 33 seconds, there's sort of this invitation to listen to the sounds and listen, become aware of your own perception and the depth of your actual perceptual abilities and capacities that you might not normally notice. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I'm just trying to recall the scene on the moon with the monolith.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition there was really powerful. Like, I'm trying to recall though, was that total silence or was that?
No, there's no total silence. Not on the moon. So the moon.
Because I remember when they're flying around in the ships.
Yeah, the moon is a choral piece by Georgi Ligeti. But instead of having an orchestra, so it's very similar to the music of the monolith, except there's no orchestra playing. The monolith music is both orchestra and voices, and the moon music is a different piece by Ligeti that's just voice. But it's the same sort of idea of really dense.
When they're
flying around in the moon ship.
The moon shuttle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then when they are on the base and they're walking towards the monolith, then it's the first monolith music with the choir and orchestra. But there's no silence. The only silence happens when any of the characters or the camera is in space. Sometimes, even though the camera is in space, you still hear the breath sounds. Sort of an interesting point of view sort of thing happening. And I think it's kind of interesting. We could talk about it even as a sort of linear progression wherein there's, first of all, there's non-diegetic music, and then there's diegetic sound effects. But then, beyond that, there's point-of-view sound effects, where you're actually hearing just the sounds that one of the characters is actually hearing. And then even beyond that, there's silence, wherein you're hearing your own sounds, right? But it's still integrated within the narrative of the movie. And I was talking yesterday about how the movie seems to, in a sense, be, you know, there's something Dalmatian about the way that it's kind of drawing us into the movie in a variety of ways, like you sit in total darkness, at various points in the movie, listening to the monolith music as though you're sort of unified with the monolith. But something similar to the way that the sound works, moving from this very abstract sort of external world of non-diegetic music to diegetic sound, to point-of-view sound, to the actual sounds that you're making, right? That perhaps seems to be somewhat related.
I thought it was really interesting, though. So the difference that I noticed between 433 seconds and 2001 in silence is that, especially the silence in the very, very beginning mm-hmm. of the movie, it, when you have...
Well, there's no silence in the beginning.
What if, I don't know when it is. It, but
well, what were you seeing? Where
it,
you
there's
seeing?
No images.
It's just a
laugh.
Yeah,
and
that's the monologue.
Yeah.
It's not silent.
Oh, is it, I thought there was a part
well,
of it.
Well, it's not actually not the monolith music. It is a piece that's very similar to the monolith music, but it's just orchestra, no choir. And it's the music that... So if you remember the psychedelic kind of screensavery stuff at the end, at first you hear the monolith music with the choir, and then at a certain point, you no longer see anything except like the lights. And it's almost like a point of view sort of thing. I guess we're sort of having a point of view shot from Dave Bowman's point of view. The music suddenly shifts to the music that you hear at the beginning in the dark room and at the intermission in the dark room.
But I guess more like what I was trying to think of is the idea that like when you have an image and you're watching something in silence, like. There's an expectation that you have, and sometimes you focus on the expectation rather than the white noise, rather than like in pitch blackness.
Uh-huh.
All you can do is listen.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good comment to move into the next. Sorry, I would agree with you.
No, it's okay.
It's a good comment to move into the next part of the lecture because I want to talk about this idea. Let's see what time
it
is.
It is 8:24.
All right. Well, I'll get through about half of the easy and correct material today, and a little bit more on Monday, I suppose. But I want to talk about easy and correct now. And you had a reading, which is pretty useful for introducing it, but also this idea of the way that your experience of listening changes when you're in a dark room. Versus when you have sounds that are always combined with images. And I'm going to blank this out because I have an outline that I'm going to use. So, first, let's talk a little bit about some of the other things in the reading that you have. I talked about the audiovisual contract and the synthesis and these things that aren't actually explained in that chapter, but I want to get into the material that is new in that chapter. The idea of three modes of listening. There are three listening modes that the author of that chapter, Michel Chion, suggests, and he's not original in this. Actually, there's a composer from the 1950s, a French composer named Pierre Schaeffer. His name is up on the website, so if you can't figure out how to spell, just look on the website. But this idea of being able now not only to structure music in a certain way, but the ways that you might actually even change your perception relative to the sorts of sounds that you hear. And the three modes of listening, as you probably remember, that it comes up with are causal listening, semantic listening, and what he calls reduced listening. Now, we've talked a lot about causal listening already, this idea that one, that sounds seem to always exist in a cause-effect relationship with motions, actions. Oh, by the way, I didn't tell you my one exception, which I think is a very useful exception. The only real exception that I can think of wherein we tend to reverse the sense of causality where sound seems to be the cause of motion, in a way, is the wind. Mm-hmm. You know, because to the extent that you're going to think about what's characteristic of the wind, well, that's certainly the feeling of it. But I suppose maybe if we just confine ourselves to film, or even many times the way we experience the wind, we tend to think of it orally first, and then think about it visually as an effect of a cause. We see the things being blown around by the wind, but the wind itself is not a visual thing. And I think this probably is the origin of the poetic metaphor of being as free as the wind, right? This idea that the causal change has been reversed, wherein that which had always been an effect sound now, in some sense, becomes a cause. If there's something about it that seems to be sort of cut loose from the normal chain of cause and effect. But causal listening is basically, there are a few different components. I suppose the more complex way of thinking about it is literally in terms of cause and effect. The way that listening helps us to orient ourselves in the world so that we can solve problems, attain goals, this sort of thing. What I mean by that is that if you're listening to the sound of a truck pausing, and you're crossing the street, and you hear the engine of the truck rev, that's very useful for your survival, right? Because it means you better get out of the crosswalk because some maniac's going to want to go, right? That's the way that very often we experience the world in terms of cause and effect, problem solving, and goal orientation, and so on. But that's a little bit different from the way that we hear sound musically or aesthetically. And so in a piece of music like 4 minutes 33 seconds, where we hear sounds that we would normally think of causally, either in terms of this orientation of cause and effect, or even just in terms of having a specific source, a specific thing that causes them, in a piece of music, what we tend to do is listen to the sound somehow abstractly. So that when you're listening to a melody, you might be listening to it in terms of, like, you know, physical construction of a clarinet and the amount of breath pressure and, you know, the physical distance and the room acoustics and these sorts of things. But by and large, what we tend to do is just talk about it in terms of a melody, which is an abstraction from physical reality. Right? A melody doesn't exist in reality. A melody is something that we, the way that we categorize the things that we hear. Right? And so there's another way of listening that moves more towards that dimension of abstraction. Now, of course, and that is more or less what the author refers to as reduced listening. This way of listening to sounds so that they're not just part of our world that we interpret in a cause-effect situation that's useful for our survival or useful for goals and that sort of thing, but to hear sound basically aesthetically instead of listening to it in terms of what caused it, or in the case of semantic listening, what does it mean? Semantics just means, refers to meaning, right? It's very interesting in the case of speech, because any sound that exists, you could potentially listen to in any of these three ways. There may be more ways to listen to sound, but these are three ways that are identified in this chapter. So, if I do this, you could listen to it causally from the point of view of, well, there's a source, this kind of creaky sewer that probably needs some maintenance. You could listen to it in terms of its meaning. What does it mean that I'm doing this? Well, what I'm doing is giving you an example of what, of different ways that you can listen to a thing. There's a semantic content to that. But you can also listen to it as music, just as, describe it in terms of its sonic characteristics, describe it in terms of its melody. You know, so if I do this, okay, there's a certain quality to that sound. It's very sharp. You can hear different frequencies. There's a high frequency and a low frequency at the same time. Maybe I can choose one that's really squeaky. Here we go. If you're very close, you can actually hear the squeak. It's like that kind of thing. Now, we could listen to that as just an effect of this chair being its source, or that it means something, that it needs to be maintained, that the room is falling apart, and I'm trying to give you an example. But you could also listen to it, in effect, on its own terms. Listen to it in itself. And that's what aesthetic experience usually amounts to, trying to listen or experience the things around us in some way on their own terms. And this is precisely what musique concrète is about. Now, musique concrète as a term is a little bit misleading. And in fact, Pierre Schaeffer, again, the composer that I'm going to be referring to several times today, actually, he coins it in the beginning of the 1950s, and by the end of the 1950s, he regrets ever coming up with the term musique concrète. But unfortunately for him, the term stuck. The reason that he describes what he's doing in terms of the music in Craig is that what he wants to do is create a new form of music wherein the technology of recording and broadcast are brought into artistic creation. And so what he does is we'll go around and record actual sounds of different objects, not musical abstract sounds, but actual sounds of objects, and turn those concrete sounds, not abstract sounds, but concrete sounds into pieces of music. But the thing that he's most interested in is not so much the concreteness of the objects, but rather the way that we can listen to the sounds around us musically instead of concretely, to sort of abstract into music the sounds of concrete objects around us. And so the reason that he ends up hating the fact that he chose to call what he was doing music concrete is that he's not actually interested in the concrete sounds and the concrete objects, but is interested in somehow listening to the world around us and the sounds of all the objects around us on their own terms. In much the way that Cage is interested in resituating the sounds around us in these like 4 minutes, 33 seconds. Now, there are many different ways that he does that, but I'll start with probably the most obvious way of doing that. You know, it's very interesting. Once recording becomes widely available in the 20th century, it really profoundly changes the way that we experience sound. Because it was previously the case, you know, if you think about this, I was reading a book about a 19th century philosopher, Søren Kierkegaard, who has many similarities to Nietzsche, except that he was kind of a fundamentalist Christian. But he talked about Mozart's opera Don Giovanni quite often, and he draws many examples from it. What's very interesting is this, like, you know, something I was thinking about, the fact that at Kierkegaard's time, the early 19th century, people would hear their favorite pieces of music maybe, you know, half a dozen times in their life.
Mm-hmm.
If you were rich.
Or you probably never heard of anything other than, like...
Yeah, so even the idea of having a favorite piece of music might not even have been a concept, right, for a lot of people. But, you know, this idea that music, and this is quite often why music in the 19th century is seen as this very sort of free art form, this symbol of freedom, because, much like the wind, it's not actually bound up. I mean, the wind is a physical thing, but poetically we tend to think of it as somehow being non-corporeal, it's somehow beyond the limits of a body. And music was not the sort of thing, especially music for large ensembles, orchestras, symphonies, this sort of thing. I mean, how many times do you think people actually heard Beethoven's Ninth Symphony? Probably not very often. I mean, you could kind of bang it out on your piano. You'd have to be a pretty good pianist to even hope to be able to play it. And even then, it's not a symphony. Just like this kind of maybe reduced version of it. Recording changes that whole picture. What recording does is, in a sense, it's twofold. We think of it basically as being great because now we can hear the sounds that we want to hear, the music we want to hear, whenever we want. But you always have to remember that any sort of progress always has a downside to it. There's always something that gets lost in any sort of shifting sort of technological process or perhaps social progress, that once sound becomes capturable in this way, in a way it loses the sort of mystery or the sort of, you could say magic or even sort of sense of freedom that it once had. The specialness is maybe a more, you know, pragmatic or neutral way to describe that. And so, once you're able to record sounds, in a sense, you have really complete mastery over the sounds. Whereas before, you know, I mean, you might be able to write a piece of music and really control the sorts of things that happen in a piece of music. But if you wanted to create a piece of music that used traffic noises or the sounds of birds or, you know, other sorts of sounds like that, there wasn't very much you could do. Once you're able to record the sounds, you can manipulate them in many, many different ways. And manipulation itself is one of the ways that Chopard is hoping to get to this sort of abstract, reduced way of hearing the sounds around us. And One of the things he'll very often do is, you know, cut up different sounds so that they no longer really sound like the object that produced them. If you take any sound, you can take like the sound of a piano, and if you just cut away everything except for the first, you know, half second or so, it's not even going to sound like a musical note. It's going to sound like somebody, you know, hitting a hammer or something on a piece of wood. It's just tap. That's what it sounds like, even though it was a pitch. If you take away the beginning of the sound, it sounds like some weird alien voice. Because one of the things that enables us to differentiate sounds, in fact, probably one of the most important things, is the way the sounds begin. The attack of the sound is one of the things that gives us the most information about sound. That's why if I say, like, for instance, tree, you all know that I said tree, but if I cut off the first half second of that, it's like tree, or even maybe the tree, right? We no longer have any. The onset of the sound, and in particular in musical cases, the thing that lets you know what instrument produced the sound is very much tied up with the first half second or so of the sound. And so, through technological manipulation, one of the things that he's able to do is really get into sort of the inner essence, the inner character of the sounds themselves, apart from the various associations they might have. The other thing that he does is adopt this practice that is sort of this imagined, I think, a historical idea that comes from the cult of the Pythagoreans. If you know anything about the mathematician Pythagoras. So you probably all know about Pythagoras as a geometer, as the father of geometry. But you might not know that Pythagoras was also, well, first of all, we don't know anything about the actual historical Pythagoras. We don't have any actual writings from Pythagoras. All we have are writings from other people talking about Pythagoras a few centuries after Pythagoras was supposed to have lived. So we don't know that much about Pythagoras. But one of the things about Pythagoras that comes down in the earliest writings that we have is that he was basically the leader of a sort of cult religion. And it seems a little bit bizarre to think this, but one of the things about Pythagoras which is interesting is that he demonstrates how mathematics and geometry are, are the formal essence of all reality. And there are mathematical proofs to show this. I don't have a board on ready to go, so I won't bother with that. We don't have time. But, you know, this idea that, as Galileo later says, that, you know, God wrote the universe in the language of mathematics. That's what's associated with Pythagoras, except without the idea of some sort of personal God, but rather that logic itself is, in some sense, the creator of the universe, and it's, and the universe is written in the language of mathematics. Now, the cult of Dionysus was very much part of Dionysus. The cult, well, also Dionysus, actually, it's related to Dionysus, and it's related to certain conventions in film and certain conventions in music and craft. But what they would do is Pythagoras would teach his lectures, but he would always do it from behind a curtain. And there's this idea that they can somehow, the students can somehow get more in touch with the essential truth, the eternal non-bodily, non-corporeal truth of the teachings if the teacher were separated physically, if they couldn't see the teacher. There's this idea that they could somehow get in touch with the truth of reality itself through this convention. And this idea of hiding the source of the sounds, so in Pythagoras' case, hiding the teacher and just speaking from behind the curtain, so hiding the source of the sounds is something that Pierre Schaeffer wants to bring back into music. And the reason that he wants to bring it back into music is because he wants to get away from listening to sounds in terms of their concrete meaning, their, you know, literal meaning, that is, in terms of their sources, in terms of the way that they exist in this cause and effect situation. And what he finds is that very often, the best way to listen to sounds is what we're interested in is reduced listening. This sort of, you could say, abstract maybe, or ideal way of listening to sound apart from their sources and associations is to listen to the sounds without seeing any of the sources, to listen to the sounds in complete darkness. And so what you see, this still happens now, again, we have a department for electronic music here at the university where they have concerts like this, where there'll just be a bunch of loudspeakers on stage, and they'll turn off all the lights in the concert hall and just hear the sound. And the idea is that, well, there are many ideas in this, but one idea is that being in complete darkness changes the way that you listen. And that's something that you were saying, right? That somehow, you know, there are different ways that you can construe what it means, but one thing that we could say is that we tend to perhaps focus, maybe even get immersed in the sound itself in a way where we're not sort of preoccupied by what it means or, having our suspension of disbelief ruptured because we see an object that clearly is not the thing producing the sound that we're hearing, this sort of thing, right? So, this is all in the interest of uncovering this thing that Pierre Schiffer calls the sound object. Now, a sound object is something that we can become aware of through these various ways of, say, reduced listening or listening in complete darkness. I will just give you a term. It's not important for you for this class, but if you are interested in electronic music, you might see this here or there. Listening to music where you have no visual cues, and usually in complete darkness, is called acousmatic music. Acousmatic. And the word acousmatic actually comes from the acousmatic poem, which were the followers of Pythagoras. So this idea of hiding the sources of the sound to somehow reveal the ideal the ideal sort of state or the ideal nature of say mathematical truths or the truth of the sound in itself is referred to as acousmatic listening. But, all of this is, these are various ways to get at this thing called the sound object. This idea of a sound that now is stripped of all the various meanings that it has, or associations that it has, or various causes and effects that it might have, to get somehow at the sound itself. This is anyway what Pierre Schiffer is interested in doing. I will say that in music and credit, it's usually, I think, much more interesting to have a situation in which sounds can, at one point, be heard very abstractly as music, as sort of just sound objects. And then at a certain point, be revealed either through texture or some other sort of manipulation to actually be a very clear sound that you associate with an object. So I talked about this already in some of the lectures, like, you could combine, I think my ridiculous example before was combining an air raid siren and a horse, the sound of a horse screaming, something like that. That you can do it in such a way where you can't, if you combine them in the right way, in the right sort of texture, you can't actually hear either of those sounds as an air raid siren or as a horse, right? But you just sort of hear it as this complex musical sound that has high and low modulation of pitch, maybe some kind of weird frenetic texture. Then at a certain point, you might somehow maybe change the pitches of the two parts, if they're further apart in pitch, or make one of the sounds drop out, such that the sound then becomes revealed to be a specific thing. Nervous sound or horse. And what's interesting about that is the way that completely unrelated sounds can somehow be fused in a way that makes sense. And it makes sense musically. It doesn't make sense because horses and nervous sounds have anything to do with each other, but rather that there are different ways of listening to the same sound. And you can manipulate that in a piece of music and fret. You can combine your sounds so that sometimes they just seem like abstract music, and then at other times they sound like specific objects that may or may not actually be related. I have a piece of music. I probably don't have time to play it in this class. You can go online. It's been recorded a few times in various places. right? It's a piece for choir and electronics. And the electronics use a lot of sounds of bells and a lot of sounds of water. And if you think about water and bells, these are two things that, on first order, just don't seem to be related at all. I mean, you don't need to have water to create bells and vice versa, right? There's not necessarily any obvious cause and effect relationship. But also poetically, it seems that water and bells seem to be at odds with each other. I mean, we think of water, one, as a a natural element, a symbol of nature, even maybe a symbol of freedom, a symbol of change. And we think of bells, heavy iron objects that are kind of the opposite of a symbol of life. In fact, usually they're the symbol of death. If you hear a really deep bell, it's going to fall. It's a symbol of death, usually. But there's also this sense, just in the sound, that the bell is a static sound, the sound of the water is constantly changing. But what's interesting is that you can create a situation in which you maybe have very small bells, right? Or you have the sound of water being poured on bells, or you use some other sort of technological electronic manipulation to make a bell sound like water through changing its texture electronically, this sort of thing. And you can create a situation in which these two things, which aren't actually related, get fused into this situation in which they seem to make sense together. But they make sense in terms of the sound objects, in terms of the reduced listening, the abstract musical characteristics. And this is very much related, as I've said many times so far, to what happens in dreams. This idea that dreams, according to Nietzsche, sort of give us a way of ordering the world around us by turning disparate things into images that are connected in this sort of reduced way, this non-literal way. It's something that's very, very descriptive of what's going on in acousmatic music, where you're dealing with recorded sounds in a musical way. So there's about 10 minutes. I think what would be good, there are a lot of music clips up on the Canvas page. You should listen to all of them, but there are two clips in particular that I think need a little bit of explanation. Excuse me, I'm not stealing water. I forgot to bring my water today. Okay, one thing that is very interesting when you start dealing with sounds in themselves versus sounds that we use to orient ourselves in the world is to take the question of semantic listening. Okay? So, semantic listening means to listen to sound in terms of what the meaning is. What does it mean? And the most obvious example of a sound that we listen to semantically is human speech. Right? In fact, I dare any of you to go listen to a recording of someone talking in your native language and try to listen to it through reduced listening. Try to listen to it just as music and try not to understand it. I think it's actually almost impossible, but it's very interesting.
It's actually, I've heard
some. Well, wait, don't get anything away, because I'm going to show you how it is possible. It's possible precisely through the sort of technological manipulation that becomes possible in the rise of music and craft in the middle of the 20th century. So, what I'd like to do is play a piece by a composer, let me get rid of the projector here. Play a piece by a composer named Steve Reich. This is on the website too, so you can listen to it outside of class. Oh dear, my sound clips are very, very disorganized, so just bear with me for a second. Oh, come on. I'll just look for it in this huge list here. Where is this? God. Oh, you know, I'll just play it from the website. That's probably going to be faster. Let me just play it from the website. I guess maybe I shouldn't have unplugged the
projector so that you can see what I'm doing here, so you know which things to access. Well, now my computer's frozen. Here we go. Come on. Jeez. There we go. All right. Okay. So, how can you listen to your own language? Now, I know that this isn't the native language of everybody in the room, but I'm only going to play one example. Try to find an example in your own native language. I think it's really important that it be in your own native language. I speak German more or less fluently, but it's not as hard to listen to German musically as it is American English. Scottish English is probably a bit more like German for me, where I understand it, but it's not so sort of ingrained in my way of construing the world that I can listen to it with some sort of distance, the sort of distance that's required for reduced listening. But try to listen to your own language musically instead of in terms of what's being said, what the meaning is. Now, it's very interesting, however, once you start recording speech, what happens? If you take some phrase of speech and just repeat it over and over and over and over and over and over again, what you'll find is that you sort of become saturated by the semantic content, so that at a certain point you stop noticing the semantic content, and it becomes much easier to hear the sort of abstract musical characteristics of the sound. And so I'd like to play a brief excerpt from this piece called Come Out by Steve Reich from 1968 to show you an example of this.
I had to, open the blues up and let some of the blues breath come out to show them.
By the way, could you hear, did you understand what he just said? I'll play it one more time. What did he just say? One of the problems is this room is really echoey, so sometimes it's a little bit hard to hear what people say.
This is somebody speaking in American English?
Yeah, but he's a black kid from the south side of Chicago who got roughed up by police during the civil rights era. And what he's saying is he had to, open up the bruise and let some of the bruise blood come out to show them. And what he's saying, I mean, it doesn't make any sense because it's only part of the sentence, but the idea is that he was roughed up, and I think that there were some reporters that wanted to talk to him, but he had some wounds, but he wanted the wounds to look a little bit more photogenic or something, I guess, and so he wanted some of the bruised blood to come out so they could show them. That's the sentence. Anyway, but listen to what happens after you start repeating it over and over again.
I had to, open the bruise up and let some of the bruise breath come out to show them. I had to, open the bruise up and let some of the bruise breath come out to show them. I had to, open the bruise up and let some of the bruise breath come out to show them.
The sounds of patience.
Come out to show them, 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 come out to show them.
But you probably also notice the rhythmic element, right?
Come out to show them, 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 come out to show them.
It's very interesting what happens if you just keep repeating speech, that it sort of becomes musicalized. And the idea is that we become saturated with the semantic content and become entrained into the melodic repetition. It's very interesting, if you listen to that for a long time, then if you go back and play the original clip, it'll sound sort of like he's breaking into song. on the Broadway. So let's listen to a little bit of this. Oh, did I pause it?
Okay. I had to, like, open the blues up and let some of the blues blood come out to show them.
Right? Doesn't it sound something like he's singing at the end? There's a great example of this by the psychologist Diana Deutsch.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible. Sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as...
It sounds like she's about to start singing it. It's very interesting, the way that speech through electronic manipulation can actually be rendered musical without actually changing anything at all. It's just a matter of repetition that creates that effect wherein you stop noticing, stop paying attention to the semantic content and are sort of freed up to listen to the sound in its musical characteristics. This is the sort of thing that Pierre Schaeffer begins with in French radio stations that he's working with, and the sort of thing that recording makes possible. We'll continue the discussion of Musique Concrète on Monday. The next movie that we have is really interesting because there are all sorts of, well, first of all, philosophically it's very interesting, and we'll spend some time on that, but one of the things that it does is use a lot of non-diegetic music. It's a compilation score, much like 2001, but most of the music in the compilation score is Musique Concrète, which is... So, like, it's pieces where the entire piece is made up out of the sounds of doors opening and closing and sort of thing. And one of the things that's really interesting is when that gets inserted into a scene, then it becomes really unclear what's music and what's sound effects. But very often, there are weird sorts of causal paradoxes happening. There's one scene where somebody's walking down a corridor in a high school, and you hear this background sound or music, it's a little unclear. It's the piece that's based on all the doors opening and closing. And it just happens that there's a moment where he walks into a room, and as he opens the door, the sound and the music is of the door slamming. Right? It's a very strange moment. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. The way that the sounds create this sort of alternate reality by being based in actual sounds, but then at the same time being music, non-diegetic music that then mixes with the sound effects and creates this really weird experience. So that's next Monday. The movie's short, so I'll have a little extra time to continue the discussion of music. But I think the movie's only about an hour or 10 minutes. So. All right, so I will see you next week. Enjoy your holiday. No, we don't have class.
No, that's Thursday. Monday.
Yeah, because of the hall.
Wait, we have a whole rest of the week off.
Yeah. So,
really?
We have extra time to do your stuff.
It's
Tuesday. We have a 5-day weekend.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Huh?
I don't know. How big is it? They go on the university website just as July
5th. Yeah. Yeah, I know. The only reason that I wanted to make sure that you were here was that to talk about the size of the file that I think it was usually like, it was like 500 megabytes.
No, I checked.
Maybe
20 megabytes.
Oh, never mind. Then it was somebody else.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just didn't remember who it was.
Do you need help?
No, I just leave it there. It's supposed to be out anyway, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Thanks. Yeah, see you later.